Exit number 11307, Reel 1.
Commander Raymond Adams, Reel 1. So could I ask you first of all then, Raymond, about your situation before the crisis? Now, perhaps I ought to establish your rank and the ship you were attached to.
In the early part of 1982, I was a lieutenant serving aboard HMS Coventry. I had been in the Navy by that stage about 6 years and had recently been promoted to lieutenant. And I was 24 years of age. And this was my second major job in the Navy outside training. My previous experience, I had been at Dartmouth as a midshipman, and then I spent a year in HMS Juno undergoing fleet training, followed by my officer watch courses, and then my first complement job was in HMS Bossington, which was a mine hunter, for about 18 months as the navigator and signals officer before joining Coventry in January 81 as the signals officer and an officer watch.
And what were you doing at the time? You know, what was your situation at the time when the crisis was bubbling up?
Coventry had recently finished a spell with Standing Naval Force Atlantic and immediately after Christmas had done a short period of weapon training before going on to exercise Spring Train, which is a 2-week exercise, primarily or thereabouts. Initially a week heading down towards Gibraltar, exercising on the way, a sort of long weekend in Gibraltar, and then a week's worth of exercising on the way back from Gibraltar. And a fairly sizable contingent of ships was involved in Spring Train. The first we heard about the crisis, we were at sea, having just completed our long weekend in Gibraltar. So we had been out for a couple of days and were carrying out high seas firings of our weapon systems, along with other air defence units who were involved in the exercise. So we were to the west of Gibraltar.
Can you remember what you heard, you know, when you initially heard about the crisis?
Very little, really. We were obviously totally involved in the exercise, and when you're in the middle of an exercise, you tend not to, obviously, not get newspapers, but you also don't listen to the World Service either. So very little of what was going on we were involved with. The Admiral staff, shortly before we had any definitive news, had been taken out of the exercise. So something was afoot, but it could have ranged from anything the Admiral had to do to a major problem. So that was nothing unusual. And we were so engrossed in the exercise and our role in it that, of course, we had no idea what was going on at all.
Did the Falkland Islands, did it mean anything to you, the South Atlantic, that part of the world?
It was a very hazy memory from school geography, and the little I knew of the battle in 1914, or whenever it was, and that was about it. So it stuck in my mind as being a coaling station somewhere in the South Atlantic.
So when were you aware that, you know, you were really beginning to become involved in this?
We had intercepted or a couple of signals which weren't actually addressed to us, but of course you take an interest in what other people are doing. Sometime in the beginning of April, and the following day or the following night, I think it was, we'd actually got a signal which said that the Argentines had invaded. And we got this signal at about 2 o'clock in the morning. So that actually stuck quite clearly in my mind. But the sort of hint of what was going on before that was quite vague, really.
Did you realise, you know, from that signal that this might involve you?
I think from the signal which we came across in the middle of the night, yes, I think then it was very apparent. And it was a little bit more disconcerting because you knew that the only people who knew who were aware of this signal were the radio operators, actually on watch at the time, myself, and then when I shook the captain, him. So actually it was a fairly small circle of people. And as the signal probably wasn't addressed to us anyway, it was only... we were trying to keep our ear to the ground, as it were.
So when did things begin to happen? You know, when did you get the order that to join the task force?
Well, probably shortly, very shortly after that. A lot of what we had to do, the exercise was curtailed almost there and then. And a lot of what was happening over the next 24 hours or so was the sort of administrative and logistic reordering of an exercise. And very shortly after that, presumably the next morning, signals were starting to come in detailing us to reorder our lives. It must have happened very quickly, but on the other hand, I can't remember anything which was a definitive, right, you're off to war, chaps, type signal. We picked things up as we went along. And then the major effort of the day was getting involved in this reordering of the forces that we had available between those who were going to go south and those who were going to go home. You know, because obviously not all the forces in the exercise were either suitable for what was required in the South Atlantic, or in fact we just couldn't throw everybody down there. I mean, we had to have some planning. So most of the early stages was involved in getting ourselves sorted out.
I was wondering about your mental adjustment, you know, enjoying these exercises and then suddenly finding that there was a possibility of being involved in a real war. Did it sort of strike you at the time?
Oh, no, I don't think so. At that time, everyone was too busy doing what they had to do, doing their job, and it wasn't until some of the relatively quieter days going down through the tropics that you actually stopped to think about it. I don't think at that time you stopped to think about anything apart from making sure your ship was in station or getting prepared for the replenishment or whatever, in those sort of terms.
When the fleet was divided, you know, into two, those going back and those joining the task force, did you have any particular feeling which part you wanted to be in?
I don't think I'd relish being in the part going home. I think I'd grown out of the craving that most young men have, which is to go to far-flung parts of the empire and die for their country. I think you grow out of that by the time you're about 19 or 20. But on the other hand, I think most of us wanted to be where it was happening. And I believe that the ship's company, we had a very good ship's company, very happy ship's company and a very good team, felt we could give a good account of ourselves, whatever we were required to do. I also believe that at the time we felt that perhaps things weren't going to end up in a shooting war, and that many of these crises which had happened in the past would be averted by diplomatic means. The whole thing seemed quite so inconceivable that it was almost daft to believe that there would be any shooting involved at the end of it. I think we wanted to be where the action was, but we didn't really believe there would be any action anyway.
This would have been prior to Easter, wouldn't it?
Is
that right?
This was about April the 2nd. I think it was slightly before Easter, because I'm sure we were going on Easter leave directly we came back.
The ships that were sent home, was there a particular reason for that? You know, were they perhaps unsuitable for the type of exercise?
The ships that were going home were primarily the least suitable for what was conceived to be our role in the South Atlantic. Having said that, I don't think they were in any way less capable units. They just had a wrong or an unsuitable or less suitable weapon fit. And also, bearing in mind our role in NATO, we couldn't neglect the fact that we still had a commitment to NATO, and our primary role in NATO in the North Atlantic is anti-submarine. Therefore, the ships that were returned to UK were primarily those, for example, the Icara Leanders, which are relatively poorly defended against air attack, but were more suitable to carry out our role in the North Atlantic and least suitable for one of the roles in the South Atlantic.
And was there any sort of interaction between those going home and those joining the task force? I mean, did you have to exchange personnel or stores or anything?
Yes, we had what I have been in, it must have been my longest replenishment ever, which lasted several hours, with, I think it was Aurora. And ships, individual ships going home were detailed to give those going south virtually everything they had in the way of consumables. They had to reduce their food supplies to about 3 days' worth, fresh and frozen. And they had to reduce, for example, other what turned out to be quite important stocks, for example, lavatory paper and beer and things like nutty chocolates, sweets, etc., and medical stocks across the whole gambit, and also any compatible ammunition, of course, was transferred. And this went on. We had, I think, we had two rigs, two positions with Aurora, and of course helicopter transfers as well. So ships were paired up, and a number of items were transferred, and some personnel were transferred, but that was more discriminating, because you had a worked up team in each ship, so you couldn't negate that. But there were occasions where one or two ships were deficient in one or two people, which is often the case, which was fine for the exercise, but actually you needed your full complement if you're going to war, so you actually had to borrow a chief petty officer from one ship or something like that.
How about compassionate cases? You know, say someone was going to be married at Easter. Would he have been considered? Would that have been considered?
I very much doubt it. I can't think of an example, because of course Sheffield had been away for some months up to then, so there were a number of reasonably compassionate cases there, but compassionate only extends so far.
And did you have any briefings at this period, you know, when you were setting off to join the task force?
Not at this stage. There was nothing to brief on. The first couple of days after this major evolution was spent in sorting ourselves out as a group, and then deciding what we had to do, because it was from a cold start. And interesting enough, this is what we had always been led to believe a war would be like. It would be a sort of come-as-you-are party, rather than having a long build-up as in 1938-39. And when it did happen, I suppose we slipped into sorting ourselves out first, and then once we got ourselves established as a group, then deciding what the threat was in individual ships, although the Admiral staff had obviously been working on this for some time. Individual ships sorting themselves out, deciding what the threat was, and then going seeing what we needed to do as an individual ship in our training, as well as group training. And only then, and of course with no intelligence to begin with, from a standing start, you then had to build up your picture, you then had to decide what to brief. So it probably wasn't until we'd been going south about 5 or 6 days that people started to were in a position to brief, obviously the captain, the warfare officers, and the main team were looking at it already. But there was nothing to brief the sailors on, for example, until you built up a reasonably composite picture.
What would you say the attitude was, you know, in the Coventry once things got going? Were you all confident that you could cope with any situation? I was wondering what you'd been trained for, and how the Falklands, you know, Islands battle, how that sort of fitted into your training scheme.
I think the ship was supremely confident. The ship's company was a very close-knit team. The ship was very new. She'd been running about just over 3 years by this stage. So we were as near the forefront of naval technology as I suppose you can get. She, in her first couple of years, had been the first ship into the Gulf in the Iran-Iraq war. And that, to all intents and purposes, was a war zone. She had been diverted there from her world deployment. And although hadn't been in action, had built up a very professional and competent ship's company. When they got back from the deployment, obviously a number of people changed, which is fairly standard. But the feeling hadn't gone. There are some ships which are always confident. And I think this is one ship. And with that core of people who'd come back from the Gulf, the confidence was built on. And during the first year I was on board, we actually worked very hard in the number of exercises we'd done. And this confidence and professionalism had increased, if anything. So by the time we got round to April of 82, the ship's company was very well motivated, a very close-knit team, which is the most important thing, and very confident in their own abilities.
I was wondering also about the flexibility of the sort of naval training, you know, whether you were sort of trained for a submarine war against the Russian. Would the Russians not have been the enemy at that particular time? And whether this was any limitation?
The Soviet threat has always been taken as the major threat. I think 82 was perhaps the turning point in our assessment of the threat. Since then, we have been perhaps more aware that the world is a more volatile place. A number of instances since 82, I've been diverted to other parts of the world. And in fact, the least threatening nation, almost, has been the Soviet and the Warsaw Pact. So I think we have reevaluated the threat. And I think we tended to discount out-of-area and third world states before 82 as being much of a threat anyway. And in fact, perhaps on the way south, we underestimated the Argentinian threat. And we tended to dismiss them a little bit. Not because of their resolve or their determination, but perhaps because of the sophistication of the weapons. We had been geared in all our exercises to countering Soviet threat, and the level of weaponry and the specific reactions against the Soviet threat. And here we were facing what was predominantly a Western threat. And that did cause us, I think, a few searching moments to work out what we were supposed to be up against. But only from that point of view, the training in general, I think, had made us very professional and more than adequate to cope with fighting a war 8,000 miles away. And I think that was borne out on the way south and on and the conduct of operations down there. If one thing stuck in my mind, it was when the Admiral visited and said, we are going to lose men and we are going to lose ships, people are going to get killed. And perhaps it wasn't until then it really hit home that we were, but that was much later, so we were more likely to end up fighting. But we were very confident up till then that we could cope with any threat that was thrown at us. And I think, so right until the last few minutes, we were able to.
So the Coventry, this is a Type 42, is that right?
Yes.
And could you tell me something about its role in war? What is it supposed to do, a Type 42?
It's primarily an air defence ship. Its main weapon system is Sea Dart, which is a medium-range anti-aircraft missile. It has twin channels of fire, in that it can engage two targets almost simultaneously. It has two 909 radars, one forward, one aft, which gives it a great deal of area cover. It's an area defence ship. It also has a 4.5-inch gun, the Mark 8 gun, which is the naval version of the Abbott gun, which is very accurate and is primarily used for naval gunfire support, i.e. land bombardment. And that's its main role, although it has subsidiary roles, secondary roles of anti-air and anti-surface. It carried a Lynx helicopter, and the Lynx at this stage in 1982 carried either Mark 44 or Mark 46 torpedoes. It could carry depth charges, and it also could carry the Sea Skua missile, although none had been fired, obviously, in anger, and very few had been fired anyway. In fact, the first firing our crew had done, I believe, was our engagement of a patrol boat about halfway through the action. And there are a limited number of missiles available anyway, because this was a fairly new weapon system. The Lynx is also very versatile in terms of its long range for surface search and for anti-submarine work as a weapon carrier and for spotting for naval gunfire support. So it's a very versatile aircraft. And the final main weapon system was two sets of triple torpedo tubes carrying Mark 46 or Mark 44 torpedoes, stews, which were primarily a sort of almost a self-defense last resort anti-submarine weapon.
And were there other ships of this nature in the task force?
The other two Type 42s were Glasgow and Sheffield, although other air defence ships, including Glamorgan, which carried the Admiral's flag for quite a while, and Antrim. And they were the main air defence ships around.
How about your signals equipment? You know, would that have been the very latest?
Communications is an evolving technology, and it's much easier to move communications equipment and bolt new equipment into racks than it is to put a new weapon system onto ships. So, yes, we were as near the forefront of technology as any other unit at sea.
So when you actually joined the task force, whereabouts would this have been?
Well, I'm not sure that we joined it. I think it must have joined us. We were... The task force, to use the term very loosely, evolved during the period when the exercise stopped and the major replenishment carried out. And we were about 100 miles, 150 miles west of Gibraltar, or thereabouts. And so that really was the initial group. The ships that were in the exercise, which were all escorts, there was no carrier there at all, and RFAs, formed the nucleus of the task group. And we then headed south, and it wasn't till we were well south of Ascension that the other ships followed on. We then had to mark time later while the other ships caught up. In fact, we in Coventry were amongst the officer watches, were a little cynical about the actual appearance of any aircraft carriers at all, Invincible and Hermes, because we didn't actually see them visually until about the 2nd or 3rd of May, because when we heard, we were always ahead of the group, always ahead of the carrier group, and we were always up threat, well, that was our role. And the first couple of days when we were in any sort of formation, close enough to see them, the visibility had clamped in. So it wasn't until about the 2nd or 3rd of May we actually saw any aircraft carriers. And we'd been away a month by that stage.
So you didn't go to Ascension Island? You didn't have to...
Yes, we did. We replenished at Ascension on the way, but we only stopped for about 18 hours.
Yeah. What was your impression? Was it a hive of activity?
It didn't look like a very thrilling run ashore. But there was a lot of activity going on. Ascension is not a place where you could get a safe anchorage for any length of time, although the weather's not generally bad. Very deep water, or you have to go very close inshore. Much of the work was done by helicopters. But at that stage, no, it probably wasn't a major hive activity. There were a lot of ships there. We all went in anchored, but picked up a few stores. And then we sailed off again. I think Ascension was still building up, but we were down there very quickly. And we then went past Ascension and went south with a fair amount of speed, commensurate with fuel economy, of course.
How about the situation with fuel? during your journey to the Falklands? Did you have tankers to supply you?
Yes, I can't remember how many RFAs were with us, but all the RFAs from the exercise would have been with us. We certainly had one Fort class, I think that was Fort Austin initially, who was part of the exercise, and of course she carries ammunition and food. And there was one or two smaller tankers, the Rover class, which are primarily fuel. And so there was a reasonable amount of fuel at that stage for our group. But of course this was going to be a major problem. I mean, it must have been 6,000 miles from Gibraltar, and that's, there's nowhere to stop on the way. Warships tend to keep topped up, and not only from a matter of contingency, but also for stability. And we tend to refuel every other day, as a matter of course. So we were able to do that. There were no problems with fuel, that I remember anyway.
Were you also given special kit? Because you were going to a different sort of area, weren't you? Weather-wise, I would imagine. Did that happen at this period?
No, the only concern was we had all in the back of our minds thought that when you went to war you unloaded all your personal kit. Of course there wasn't anywhere to unload it unless you dropped it over the side, so it all stayed on board. Special kit, no, it wasn't issued. Those of us who lived on board all the time, as opposed to the married men who lived ashore in Portsmouth, had all our tropical kit on board, so that was no problem. Those who had brought a minimum amount for the exercise were scrabbling around for a bit more, going through the tropics, of course, but we went from temperate climes through the tropics back down to chilly temperate climes at the other end of the world. Well, no, we didn't get anything special. There were a few odds and ends which were broken out for upper deck crews, cold weather clothing. The ships carried those anyway, but nothing was given to us specially.
And you, as signals officer, you know, were you able to sort of follow what was happening diplomatically, the broadcast, say, from the World Service? I wonder what your expectations were as you were sort of going nearer the Falklands. Were you realising that it was getting more and more serious?
I think until about the last few days of April, we were still optimistic that the whole thing would be averted. Most of our diplomatic sources of information came from the World Service, which, when a ship is deployed, tends to be put over the main broadcast anyway, so the whole ship's company are able to listen to the news and things like that. So the in between exercising on the way south and getting our lives in order, we had a sort of garbled picture of a number of people jet-setting around the world in seemingly random directions, trying to avert a shooting war. But anything more detailed than that, for example, the situation in Argentina, was totally beyond us in terms of how we saw it.
And were you getting more briefings, you know, as time was going on, you know, as to the Argentinians, what weapons they had? For instance, I wondered if you knew at this stage they had exocets.
The intelligence sources, well, the intelligence picture built up as we went south, that became greater as attention focused on it. I'm not sure beforehand whether we considered Argentina to be a major threat and how much effort was put in building an intelligence picture. All warships carry a certain base of intelligence material anyway. And of course you can always supplement that by the well-known publications such as Jane's, which if for no other use is actually quite a good source of information. Particularly if you can afford the up-to-date issue. Exactly how much they had, well, that still was a matter of some conjecture. And although intelligence reports come in, you tend to be a little sceptical that is actually the true picture. Otherwise, you could end up deluding yourself. So we were getting more reports as we went south, and we were then in a position to brief the ship's company on what was going on.
You were saying about the Admiral. Did he actually visit the Coventry? Did he come to your ship personally at any time? This would be Admiral Woodward, would it?
Yes. He visited us for about 2 to 3 hours. And I think he managed to visit all the ships heading south. I believe this happened before the carriers joined us, so it would have been a relatively early stage, while we were still a sort of small spearhead of the group. And he obviously briefed the captain. He chatted in the wardroom for about an hour and talked to the senior aides and talked to the ship's company.
Mm-hmm. What, do you think it's important that, you know, he visited the ship?
I think it is important. We were all interested to hear what he had to say and ask questions, but I don't think we learnt anything from it. It was a sort of morale booster, but I don't think it was another source of information, because what he had to say wasn't a great deal more than we knew anyway. And in fact, as we had taken a great deal of interest in what was going on right from the outset, including...